If you would, please turn to John chapter 7. We'll be continuing our study of John tonight. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you a question. How many of you have ever watched or seen or read an old play called 12 Angry Men? They made it into a movie and then they redid it again more recently as a movie. Have you ever see that? Ever read that play? I had to read it when I was in school. It was one of those school assignments. We had to read it and discuss it and answer questions about it. It's an interesting play, an interesting concept. Of course, it's about the court system and the jury. And in the case, there's this seemingly open and shut case, and these 12 men get in there, and of course, the air conditioner's broken, and it's the hottest day of the year, and they've got to deliberate, and they're all ready to just vote and get it over with, and so they take the vote. And 11 people are voting, oh, he's guilty. We just know he is. One man says, wait a minute, I'm not going to vote guilty. And so then they start discussion. Okay, well, we're going to convince you he's guilty. And then as they begin to go down through the pieces of evidence, instead of them convincing him that the man is guilty of the crime, each piece of evidence comes into question. And each piece of evidence is examined more closely. And faults and flaws and false testimony and all of these different things start to come in. And then they take a vote a little bit later, and instead of just the one guy, there's now three people. And then a little while later, there's five. And then they take another vote, and there's seven. And before long, they wind up. When all of them were ready to just say, oh, he's guilty, and let's throw away the key. Lock him up and throw away the key. By the end of it, after they've really, really dug deep and examined the evidence, they've completely changed their mind, and they wind up acquitting him of it. And it's interesting the way that the evidence, at first glance, you know, it seemed like it was, oh, well, yeah, he's guilty. But when they looked at the evidence more closely, they were convinced otherwise. That's what John calls on his readers to do. Examine the evidence a little more deeply. You see, at first glance, people say, wait, this carpenter's son from Nazareth comes up here and he starts spouting stuff about being a teacher from God and all of these kind of things. He's just crazy. There's just something wrong with that boy. And John says, look at the evidence a little more closely. And as John goes through and begins to lay out piece after piece of this evidence and says, okay, let's examine this, and let's look at this, and let's look at that. And as he goes along, that's why he says by the end of the book, these things I have written that you may believe in the Son of God. He wrote these things because he had the real evidence, instead of just the superficial evidence. So let's look as we get into John 7, and we're going to see some of those pieces of evidence as we look at this. We ended last week, and we want to kind of pick up right where we left off. We ended last week about verse 20. And really in verse 19, he asks the question at the end of the verse, why do you go about to kill me? Why are you trying to kill me? That's what Jesus asked. And in verse 20, the people said, you've got a devil, you've got a demon, you are demon-possessed. Not just crazy, you're demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you? What's wrong with you? Nobody's trying to kill you, you're making this up. You're imagining that you've got a demon that's telling you this crazy stuff. Now, who's right? Jesus says, you're trying to kill me. Why are you trying to kill me? They say, you're crazy. Nobody's trying to kill you. Now, they can't both be right, can they? Either there's people wanting to kill him, or else there's not people wanting to kill him. If there's not people wanting to kill him, then there is something wrong with his thinking. He's wrong. He's a little paranoid or something. But if people are wanting to kill him, then they're lying, and he's telling the truth. Now let's examine the evidence and let's see who it is, which way it goes. So then in verse 21, Jesus said, I've done one work, one miracle in other words, and you all marvel. Now remember, he'd done a lot of works around But he had come to Jerusalem, and he had healed the man. And you remember, it was on the Sabbath day that he'd healed the man. And they were upset at him for healing the man on the Sabbath day. Instead of glorifying God that a man was healed, they were upset because he did it on the Sabbath day, and you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. And so they were upset at him. And so as we look at this then, Jesus gives his argument in verse 22. He says, okay, you're upset at me about this. Moses gave you circumcision. It's in the law of Moses. You circumcise every boy on the eighth day. And interestingly enough, we could get into the details of why. There are some amazing medical reasons that God chose that day. And if you don't know about those, it's an interesting thing to get into. But basically, if a little boy's going to have surgery, the eighth day of his life is the perfect day for him to have surgery. Because the part of his blood that causes clotting is higher on that day than it has been up to that point, or than it ever will be in the rest of his life. It's a peak point for surgery. And God chose that day, of course, for the circumcision, which is a form of surgery. Now he says, now that's not because it was of Moses. In other words, Moses didn't come up with this. Moses wasn't the first one that did circumcision, was he? It was part of the law, but it actually came from before. It goes all the way back to Abraham. He said it was of the fathers. And he says, you'll circumcise a little boy on the Sabbath day. You see, they understood circumcise on the eighth day of the little boy's life. Don't work on the Sabbath day. Some little boys were born on Friday, so guess what the eighth day of their life was? Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Saturday. It's the Sabbath day and it's his eighth day. What are we going to do? God said don't work on the Sabbath, but God said circumcise the little boys on the eighth day. Which one are we going to do? Because we got to do one or the other. We either got to disobey the command to circumcise the boy on the eighth day, or we're going to have to do the circumcision, do the surgery, and somebody's going to have to do a little bit of work. And Jesus said, you circumcise the boy on the eighth day if it's the Sabbath day. And God didn't find them guilty of violating the Sabbath day when they did that. And so Jesus explains to them, look, you understand that the Sabbath, not working on the Sabbath, is not a 100% you never do anything on the Sabbath. That's you don't always do nothing on the Sabbath. There are some things you do. In fact, he said, hey, on another occasion, in another place, he said, hey, don't you loosen your ox or your mule and let them go get a drink of water on the Sabbath day? Well, now technically you could say that's work. You loose the ox, you let him go get some water, you tie him back up. Well, that's work. That's farm work right there. But they understood, you know, you got to let the animal drink. You got to let him have some water. You got to let him have some food. And so Jesus then says, okay, if you've got this example here where you do this on the Sabbath day, he says, if a man on the Sabbath day receives circumcision so that the law of Moses should not be broken, why are you angry at me? Because I have made a man completely whole on the Sabbath day. You see, Jesus didn't just do a little surgery. He actually healed a man and made him completely healthy again. And so he points out their hypocrisy. They're okay with the circumcision on the Sabbath day, but they weren't okay with him performing what was similar to a surgery, but miraculous, and doing that on the Sabbath day. And then he says something in verse number 24 that we need to all take note of. We have been hammered over the head with Matthew chapter 7. Judge not, lest you be judged. Don't judge. And yes, Jesus said that. Of course, people don't generally read the rest of that context. We'll look at that in another time. But we hear that all the time. Don't judge, judge not. Here, Jesus makes some clarifying statements about what kind of judgment is good and what kind of judgment is bad. Notice what he says. Judge not according to appearances. but judge righteous judgment. So Jesus here says there's two kinds of judging. There's one that you shouldn't do, and one that you should. There's one that's just according to the way things look, and the other is righteous. It's based on the facts. It's based on what's right. You ever been judged by somebody based on appearance? Because something looked a certain way to somebody, and so they judged you harshly because of it? Has that ever happened to you? If we think about it, most of us probably have had somebody judge us unfairly because they just thought something looked like something. But Jesus says, don't judge that way. Instead, when you do judge, you judge righteous judgment. You judge according to what's real and right and factual and true. We need to realize that God does not condemn all judgment. Jesus did not condemn all judgment. He just said, when you make your judgments, make sure you're judging accurately. Now, if I'm walking down the street and I see two people walk up to each other and one sticks something in his pocket and the other one, now I can assume all sorts of, that must have been a drug deal just took place right there. I just saw a drug deal. So that's what it looked like. Now maybe it was, but maybe it wasn't. There are lots of other possibilities, aren't there? There are lots of things that could have been going on right there that I have no idea about. And if I judge, there's a couple of, you've got a druggie and a drug dealer right there. Now, if I see them get the drugs out and they're looking, and then they're handing them off and trading money, then I can know what's going on. But if I just see somebody, they're passing something hand to hand, I don't know. I might kind of wonder if that might have been what they were doing, but I can't judge that just based on it kind of looked that way. It had that appearance. So what we've got to realize is things don't always look to us like they really are in reality. Let's imagine for a minute two cars on the highway where the speed limit's 70 miles an hour, on the interstate. The speed limit's 70 miles an hour. Both of these cars are driving 100 miles an hour. One of them is breaking the law and the other one's not. Now, how do you suppose that could be? Well, there's several possibilities. The most obvious, obviously, would be one of them is a car that's speeding and the other one is the police car that's chasing him. Well, there are a lot of situations. And there's another situation. Two cars driving down the road, the speed limit's 70 miles an hour. They're both driving 70 miles an hour, but one of them's breaking the law and the other one's not. How could that be? They're both driving 70 miles an hour and that's the speed limit. It looks like they're both doing what's right. But there's lots of possibilities there too, isn't there? One of the fellows may be driving a stolen car. One of them may be driving without a license. One of them may be going the wrong way down the interstate. He's in the wrong lane. Driving the right speed, but he's on the wrong side of the median. That could be very bad. You see, there's a lot of... Sometimes we just assume when we hear something or we see something, we just assume we know. And we don't always know. We need to be aware of that. We need to find out the facts. And that's one of the things Jesus is telling them. Look, you saw me do something on the Sabbath day, and so you assumed I'm breaking God's law. I wasn't breaking God's law. I was healing a man. I was doing God's will. I was actually helping someone who was created in the image of God to be completely healthy again. That's what God wanted me to do. But you're judging me for this just because it looked like I was breaking your little don't work on the Sabbath law when I wasn't. We have to watch out for that. It's very easy for us to want to do these things. Now verse 25 then is amazing. After he says those things, Now you remember the question he asked earlier. Why are you trying to kill me? What, are you crazy? You got a demon. Nobody's trying to kill you. Look at verse number 25. Then some of the people from Jerusalem said, isn't this the one they want to kill? What are our witnesses say? What's our evidence? Who was telling the truth back there a while ago? You see, the witnesses are saying, hey, wait a minute. This Jesus, this is the guy they want to kill. So who was right? Jesus when he said they wanted to kill him, or them when they said, what? We don't want to kill him. What are you talking about? Our witnesses are corroborating Jesus' side of the story, aren't they? They're saying, hey, yeah, this is the guy they want to kill. And then here's the amazing part. They recognize this too. But notice, take notice of this. Lo, when you see the word lo or behold, it's kind of like, take notice. This is something important. Notice this, they say. He's speaking boldly, and they don't say anything to him. You know why they wanted to kill him? Because they couldn't answer him. They couldn't win an argument with him because they didn't have a leg to stand on logically or reasonably or factually. They couldn't win, and so they jumped to emotion. Well, let's just kill him then. Now we've got to watch out. It is in our society today, and especially in the religious world, it is emotion run wild. People have thrown reason and sensibility and common sense and the Word of God out the door. And it doesn't matter. It's all about how I feel about it. That's exactly what these folks were doing. Jesus is trying to tell them truth, and he's trying to speak reason and logic and be understanding with them and teach them how to understand. And instead, they jump to emotion. Let's just kill him. That's an emotional response. See, the logical response would be, wait a minute, he's not right. Let's get the answers to respond to him and prove that he's not right about this. But they couldn't, because there weren't any answers to prove that he wasn't right. Everything they came up with only backed him up instead of them. And we've got to be very careful that we don't get caught up. God created us with emotions as human beings. He created us to be happy and sad, to get angry sometimes, to even to the point of being depressed sometimes, even to the point of laughing and giggling sometimes. He created us with emotions. We are emotional beings in some form. But he also created us with an intellect that is able to control that emotional nature, that emotional part of us, so that we're not ruled by the emotional state. You see, a lot of the animals are ruled by their emotion. If a deer gets afraid, what's that deer going to do? It's going to do one of two things. It's either going to freeze or it's going to run. The deer does not think what's the smart thing to do in this situation. The deer either freezes or runs. And it's a 50-50 chance. Now, you ever come running down the road and come around a curve and there's a deer in the middle of the road. When he sees those headlights, he or she, he's going to do one of two things. You're going to freeze right there in the road in front of you, and I've had plenty of them do that, or they're going to run. Now, sometimes they're off on the side, and they're either going to freeze or they're going to run. Now, if they're in the road, you want them to run, but they don't always do what you want them to do. If they're on the side of the road, you just assume them freeze. Because if they're going to run, you know, they don't always run off into the woods, do they? Sometimes they run right in front of the car. They don't think. They just react emotionally. I'm afraid. I'm gonna. And they don't think about the consequences. They don't even think about which direction to run. They run right into danger sometimes. We're not deer. We're not animals. God gave us intellect so we can look at a situation. Are we going to have fear sometimes? You ever been afraid? If you say no, I know you're a liar. We've all been afraid at one time or another in our life. But what do we do when we're afraid? We just react and run or freeze like the deer? Well, sometimes that's what people do. But God gave us a mind to be able to analyze the fearful situation and think, what should I do? And then do the right thing. Do something to get us out of that dangerous situation instead of running further into it or instead of just freezing. He gives us that ability. Now, whether we use that ability or not, it's up to us. But Jesus has this ability to think and overcome his emotion, but the people are reacting like animals. They're just reacting on emotion. We don't like what he says, and we can't argue against what he says, so we just kill him. But those, the people respond. He's speaking boldly, and they won't say anything to him. And then the people start to think, wonder why. Why aren't they, you know, if he's a false teacher, then they ought to, they know the law. They know the scripture. They ought to stand up and say, hey, you're a false teacher. You get out of here. Or they ought to be able to bring him to trial and convict him of being a false teacher. And realize, of course, you know, it's different than the church. We can't take somebody to court because they're a false teacher in today in the church. But in Judaism, the state and the religion, you know, it was all together. They could actually have a court. Their ruling court was a religious court. So they could actually take somebody to court if they were a false teacher, and they could convict them of heresy. They could convict them of trying to lead people astray, and they could execute them under the law of Moses. Now, the Romans didn't like that too much. But they could do it legally and logically and reasonably if they wanted to, but they didn't do that with him. And so the people start to think, I wonder if the rulers know that he really is the Christ. People are starting to question. They're looking at the evidence, and they're starting to say, you know, the rulers are saying this guy's a nobody, or that he's wrong, or that he's a liar, or that he's got a demon. They're saying these things, but you know what? I'm starting to wonder if they really know that, in fact, he is the Messiah. And that's why they're not talking. That's why they're not speaking up and saying something. Is it possible? And so then, the other side says, well, wait a minute. Okay, well, I understand where you're going with that, but wait a minute. They say, now, we know where this man came from. We know he's from Nazareth, over there in Galilee. We know that. But when the Christ comes, no man's going to know where he comes from. So they've stacked it. Okay, well, you know, it seems like maybe this is the Christ, but wait a minute. Here's this piece of evidence that seems to say, no, wait a minute, this isn't the Messiah. Now, I've always wondered why they said this, why they believed this. The indication is, according to the Scriptures, that they would know where the Messiah, the Son of David, the King, was going to come from. Because remember when those wise men stopped and they asked Herod about it, and Herod asked his scholars about it, where the Messiah, the King of the Jews, was going to be born? And they went and they searched out and they said, oh yeah, hey, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem. Now, so I could understand if they said, hey, wait a minute, this guy's from Nazareth and the Messiah is supposed to be from Bethlehem. But instead they say, we don't know where he's supposed to come from. That didn't make a whole lot of sense, because somebody knew where he was supposed to come from. They knew that he was supposed to have been born in Bethlehem. But you know, sometimes the arguments that people throw up to try to confuse the issue or to try to turn you away from Christ, sometimes they don't make a lot of sense. Sometimes they're not reasonable arguments. They're red herrings. They're falsehoods. They're assumptions that are not accurate, that are just thrown in there. Then Jesus, you see, he always knows what they're thinking, doesn't he? He answers them. Look at verse 28. Jesus cried in the temple, you know me and you know where I came from, and I have not come of myself, but the one that sent me is true, and you don't know him. But I know him because I am from him, and he has sent me. And here we go again, verse 30. Then they tried to take him away, but no one laid hands on him because his time or his hour was not yet come. Wasn't time yet. So they couldn't even lay their hands on him. They wanted to get him, but they couldn't. And then notice verse 31. Many of the people believed on him. And they said, well, when the Christ comes, is he going to do more miracles than this guy's doing? This kind of goes back to, Cameron was talking about this in the first Sunday. He was talking about, you know, how Isaiah had prophesied. He's going to do this, and he's going to do this, and he's going to do this, and he's going to do this. And they're starting to look at that very thing. And they're saying, well, now, wait a minute. If this guy is doing some miracles, some serious miracles here. When the Messiah comes, is he going to do more than this? Is the Christ going to do more than this? The Pharisees heard about that. How do you suppose they felt? What do you suppose they thought when they realized that people were starting to really think, this could be the guy. This could be the Christ. This guy is doing the things that the Christ is supposed to do when he comes. Well, when they heard these things, the Pharisees and the chief priests sent some officers to take him. They said, enough of it. Now remember, they already tried to take him once, but they couldn't even get their hands on him. So now, they get some officers, some soldiers, some policemen, if you will. You go get him. Go arrest him. Now, I'm not sure yet what he's done to be arrested for. But they're getting serious about this thing now. They're starting to really... We've got to take care of this because people are starting to be swayed by the evidence. So we got to cover it up. We got to stop this thing before it gets out of control. And by out of control, they meant out of our control. Their biggest fear was loss of power, loss of control. And there are some people today that still have that fear. There are some who will not fully put their trust and faith in Jesus Christ because it means a loss of control. It means I've got to give my will over to Him. And I can't have control over my life anymore. I've got to do what He wants me to do. And that can be scary for some people. It was sure enough scary for the Pharisees and the chief priests. A little bit of a cliffhanger here. They sent them to arrest them. Of course, if you read ahead, you'll find out what happens. But are they going to get him this time? I always love those old shows that always leave you with the cliffhanger. What's going to happen next time? You got to tune in next time to find out. But what are we going to do? Are we going to continue? Are we going to examine this evidence? Are we going to continue to look at these things seriously like these people are starting to do, and they're starting to say, wait a minute, this over here, this is on Jesus' side. But wait, what about this? That's stacking up on Jesus' side too. And the evidence that starts to say, hey, he is innocent, he is the Christ, is starting to mount up, starting to stack up. It's adding up. Is it going to be enough to get all the way to the conclusion, yes, this is the Christ, He is the Son of God? We're going to have to find that out next time as we finish up chapter 7 next time. But look at these things that are going on here. He's doing miracles. He's teaching. And He can't be beaten by sound reasoning. And so the people that are opposed to Him are starting to get desperate. The people that are opposed to Christ never can win in a battle of ideas and in a battle of reasoning and thinking. And so they always have to jump the track. They have to get out of being reasonable, thoughtful people and get into emotional reactions to get there. Now, that's not to say that all emotion is bad. We already talked about that. God created us with emotion. He wants us to feel emotion. One of the emotions He wants us to feel is the shame and guilt of our own sin. And far too often, we don't feel that emotion. He wants us to repent, have remorse, godly sorrow for our wrongdoing and come back to Him. Sometimes we miss that. He wants us to have faith. He wants us to have love for Christ. Now, love is more than just an emotion, but there is an emotional aspect to love that shows itself through the actions that we take. He does want us to have emotion. But He wants us to have emotion based on facts, not based on lies, not based just on what we want or wish, but on what really is. If you're not a Christian, you need to become one tonight. If you are a Christian, but perhaps you haven't been fully trusting and following Jesus Christ, you've given Him some, but not all.